From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview from the archives with Vermont children's author Elizabeth Blumley about her picture book, Tap Tap Boom Boom, which was published by Candlewick Press. Elizabeth Blumley is the author of How Do You Waka Waka? And My Father, the Dog, both illustrated by Randy Cecil, and Dogs on the Bed, illustrated by Anne Wilsdorf. Elizabeth Blumley lives in Vermont, where she owns the Flying Pig Bookstore in Shelburne. G. Brian Karras is the illustrator of Tap Tap Boom Boom. When I spoke to Elizabeth, I asked if she could begin by reading from Tap Tap Boom Boom. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Tap, tap, dark clouds. Tap, tap, damp air. Tap, tap, cold drops of rain dot hair. Street carts appear. Umbrellas here. Tap, 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 boom, boom. Tap, 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 boom, boom, crackle, boom. Got a storm, big storm in bloom here soon. Sky grumbles, rain tumbles, big weather. You'd better get under umbrella, boom, boom. That's right, slam, bang, hold tight to umbrella. Wind whirls, helter, skelter, boom, boom. And then it goes on and all of the people gather under the subway for shelter. And then, so they're waiting at the bottom of the landing, right at the base of the stairs, and people are coming down, and the text goes on later to say, downstairs we wait, folks congregate, we squeeze. Whose feet and knees are these? And you see these little dogs coming down the stairway. It's very cute. Hey, hey, watch spray. We get more wet. Tap, 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 boom, boom. And you see the dogs shaking themselves off and people shaking their umbrellas. Anyway, and it goes on, and they're just some really sweet vignettes, and all of these were things that I actually saw in the subway when I was waiting out a storm in New York City. And I took note. I started taking notes because it was just charming. There was a lady who just handed this college student her umbrella. They didn't know one another. She was on her way inside. He was on his way up into the pouring rain, and she just handed off her umbrella to him without a word.
So nice.
They just smiled, and it was so great. And then this really big guy came down the stairs holding a tiny yellow umbrella that must have been his little daughter's. And it was just hilarious. You know, and then two people would come in crowded under one umbrella. It was very, very communal, and mm-hmm. I loved that about it, which is what I loved about living in cities, always, is those little moments with strangers that you get.
Yeah, thank you for reading from the book. It's funny because I have a very distinct memory of being in New York when it started to rain, and I don't go to New York that often, you know, every couple of years for a little trip, and we were standing in line for tickets in Times Square, and big fat drop, number one, number two, and these people came out of nowhere to sell umbrellas.
Exactly.
For like, you know, $4, and you're like, wow, that was really quick.
I know, these rolling carts, and they're
so funny.
$4.99, umbrella, umbrella.
Yeah, and exactly. Yeah. It was, and everybody bought one and then got back in line for the tickets. I loved this book, and I loved the way that the illustrator interpreted your text, and I wanted to talk a little bit about that. Did you... Who informed the illustration beyond just Brian Karras, G. Brian Karras, who's the illustrator? So did you have conversations with him? Did your editor have conversations with him?
Well, the way it works in traditional publishing, generally speaking, mm-hmm. The way it works generally is that the author and illustrator work separately.
Okay.
And I will share with my editor some ideas that I have. If there's something important that needs to be conveyed that isn't in the text, I'll share that with my editor, or I'll put in an art note. I try to avoid art notes. Generally, they're not necessary, and the artist, it's the artist's book too. Mm-hmm. And so the author needs to step back at that point and really let the illustrator create the book alongside the text. And that can be hard to do sometimes. If you have a vision of the book, but what an illustrator brings is so much richer than anything I would bring visually, because I'm not an artist in that way. And so it's a wonderful exercise to step back and see what happens. I do get to see sketches. Candlewick is great about letting me see sketches, and if I have comments or questions, I can share them with my editor, and who shares them then with the art director of the project, mm-hmm. who will then share whatever he or she feels is relevant with the illustrator. So they're kind of two gatekeepers between author and artist, and I think that's really for the artist's benefit, so that the author isn't stepping all over the process.
Right. Yeah.
And that's also true. Sometimes an artist will want to make a textual suggestion, and again, there are those kind of layers in between. I think once you have a relationship with an artist, it would be possible and sometimes even more fruitful to be able to work together. There's a local children's book illustrator, Liza Woodruff, uh-huh. who's done wonderful books, and she and I have tootled around on a project together, and we work together really well because we're very respectful of each other's piece of it, uh-huh. but we have great feedback and we're both very open to hearing it, and it's fun. And I think sometimes you can get a really cohesive book when the people work together.
Now, have you done a book together?
We have not. Oh. We've done sketches and samples for a book. This was years ago, and we sent it around a little tiny bit and got nibbles, but then we both got busy with separate projects and we haven't come back to it, but I'd like to, because it's a fun project.
Right, and it sounds like it's just a very different way of approaching a project, because that's not how it's done.
Well, it can be done okay. that way, and often if an artist and an author team up together before the book is pitched, that then they do come in as a team and they do work together however they work best. Or I think once you establish a relationship with an illustrator and you do several books together, those barriers come down. And I think everyone trusts that you're not going to interfere with the other person's process.
Okay, but how awful if you came in as a team and the publisher only wanted
that can
the
happen.
Art or the text.
That can happen. Mm, yeah,
that'd be
and you need to either be clear that it's a all or nothing, or you're willing to separate.
Yeah.
But I think that could be tricky.
Yeah it could. The art in this book is a mix of drawings and photos and color and almost like sepia tones. Mm-hmm. Some of the buildings are kind of brown tones, photography looking. I don't know how that.
Yes, they are. It's a collage, yeah. And painting, right?
Beautiful. Just really, I so enjoyed it, and I loved that that even though there's a seriousness about the buildings and the photographs, there's an absolute joy about the drawn characters, I guess sort of cartoon children. Just beautiful.
Well, he's done lovely. They are very joyful, and you kind of want to pick them up off the page even. They're so cute. I felt that way about Randy Cecil's little people in How Do You Waka Waka. I just wanted to pick those little people up.
It's almost like color forms.
Yeah,
funny,
they're just adorable and very happy. And he does a beautiful, Brian Karras does a beautiful job with the art of evoking the feeling of being in the city, and those yellow skies that happen in a summer thunderstorm.
Yeah.
Which I had not thought of yellow skies when I was writing it. I was thinking of that lowering gray, but it really is a yellowy gray, and I thought he did a great job with that.
It's very evocative of what happens in the city in a storm, definitely. I wanted to talk a little bit about the play of language and rhyme in this book, and it's not direct rhyme. It's just more playful rhymes and near rhymes. And I wondered if you wanted to talk a little bit about that. And also, it struck me that that was the perfect way to treat a book that finds its motivation around the weather.
Mm. It is kind of that jazzy, syncopated feeling. It's not as regular. My Dogs on the Bed was a rhyming book. How Do You Waka Waka is a rhyming book. And both are very rhythmic. Dogs on the Bed has a very regular rhythm. How Do You Waka Waka is a little looser and more changeable, but it's also still very predictable. Tap Tap Boom Boom mimics the storm, and it isn't as regular to the ear as the other two books are, which troubles some readers, but I think once you read it out loud and once you read it with kids, I think it all falls into place. But I think when you're reading it yourself the first time, there's a little bit of practice maybe that goes into it.
Which is interesting because you're reading it in your head. You're not necessarily reading it out loud, but hearing you read it out loud just now was so much fun for me because it just was perfect and fun, you know? And in our heads, maybe we're looking for the rhymes more.
Maybe. You know? It's funny because it's so, to me, it's so much a part of the story, the rhythm, that it is hard for me to hear it the way someone who isn't familiar with the story would read it out loud to themselves. So it's great for me to ask a cold reader to just read the manuscript out loud, and that way I can hear where the stumbles are,
yes,
where the rhythm isn't working. That is really helpful,
right,
to do with a rhythmic picture book.
It's almost like reading poetry out loud, you know, because not all poetry rhymes. And like, for example, I have occasionally interviewed a poet where I'll say, ooh, may I just read this little stanza and ask you about it? And then it becomes very clear I should not be the one reading the stanza.
Although, I mean, you can look at that as that is something that the book has to answer to.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, everyone can read Dr. Seuss the way it was intended to be read out loud. There isn't any question about where the stresses fall.
Right.
And I have always had my own quirky sense of rhythm that makes absolute sense to me, and it isn't regular in that way, in that Dr. Seuss way. And anyway, but it's very regular for me, and I have a drum beat I have an internal sort of jazzy drum beat thing going on when I write,
yeah,
that is very integral, I guess, to who I am as a writer and the way I think about language. And so when I go do school visits, I'll often bring drums or have a drum beat on my laptop that will go behind my reading.
Oh, neat.
That that helps establish kind of the pace and the
fun
and the rhythm of it.
The other thing I would say is that a storm does not have an exact rhythm. A storm comes, you know, you might count to five expecting that thunder, and it'll be six. You know?
Yeah. Well, and I'm hoping that the pace of that, of the way the storm unfolds in the story, does mimic a real storm.
Oh, absolutely.
That it starts very quietly and softly and builds, and then there's this kind of crazy crescendo, and it tapers off, and yeah, then it resolves. So I'm hoping that that's reflected in the language.
Absolutely. I just want to read a quote that's relevant to what we're talking about, but also to move into my next question. The New York Times did an article called New York State of Mind about children's books that deal with New York City. And this is just a little quote about Tap, Tap, Boom, Boom. The onomatopoetic, I can't say that, onomatopoetic title used as a refrain in the text renders the sound of big juicy raindrops splattering on concrete as thunder cracks overhead. Elizabeth Blumley's rhymes are more free jazz than swing, but I think anyone reading aloud will quickly get the hang of the text and learn how to have fun with it. So number one, yes, that's what we're saying. How did you react to knowing that this article was in the world? Was this a total surprise to you?
It was very exciting to think that my book would be in the New York Times.
I know, right?
That's the first book of mine to hit the Times.
Yay.
And while I was hoping that the reviewer would immediately get my rhythms and think they were fantastic, I was okay with him thinking that it would take a little practice. Because I think that's true.
Oh, I don't know. I thought he was very embracing of your rhythms.
What I did love about that especially was that he talked about the ordinary magic of that moment, and that exactly nailed that, having that something very ordinary can become extraordinary.
Yes.
And I do think that that's one of the most wonderful things about life in a city, and I think he really nailed that.
Yeah.
What I was trying to do, and that was, it was incredible to be,
yeah,
in the New York Times.
In the New York Times,
yeah,
absolutely. The magical moment that he talks about, to me, that was very much about the city experience of community. And you've written books that both take place in city and country, so I wondered if you want to talk a little bit about the difference, if you can, if it's something you've ever thought about the difference between writing books about the city versus writing books that aren't in the city.
I think it's funny that when I lived in New York City, I was writing books set in homes that were at a country setting. And when I moved to Vermont, I started writing little, you know, sort of homage pieces to urban life.
Isn't that funny?
That getting a little distance makes you appreciate that place. And I do feel like my two city books, How Do You Waka Waka and Tap Tap Boom Boom, do celebrate what I love about the way a city brings strangers together as neighbors and New York City has a reputation for being unfriendly, but I never found that. I think you could stop anybody on the street and ask for directions, ask a question, and they may be direct and they may be rushed, but they're very willing to help and very friendly. You just have to know how to interpret New York friendly.
Yeah. It's got more to do with like a turn of phrase or a tone of voice that isn't all, you know, big embrace. It's a different kind of embrace.
Right. So, it's a very practical,
yeah,
matter of fact, we're going to get it done, and then you'll get on your way and I'll get on mine.
Right, right.
But that's not unfriendly for New York. It's actually quite friendly. People are so willing to help.
Yeah.
And you do. You have 1,000 moments with strangers on the bus, on the subway, on the street. You just catch somebody's eye and you're both laughing about the same crazy thing that's going on 10 feet away from you.
That you want to stay 10 feet away from.
That you want to stay 10 feet away from. And you just have those moments. They're great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember once being in New York and there was a guy selling pottery on the street, you know, off of a table. And I fell in love with this pot, but he didn't take a credit card and I didn't have any cash. And he said, just take it. Here's my card. Send me money. And I was like, are you kidding? We're in New York. People don't do that. Well, people do. They surprise you, you know.
Yeah. I think New York is one of the friendliest places I've ever lived. I mean,
yeah.
Vermont, it took me much, much longer to get to know people,
mm-hmm,
because of the New England kind of reserve.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Okay, great. We talked about this a little bit in our last interview, but I wanted to touch on it again. If you could talk a little bit about your early reading experiences and the books that you fell in love with that put you on this path for your lifetime of books. I mean, you own a bookstore, you've worked in publishing, you're a writer, so...
I learned to read before I can remember learning to read. My parents always said I was 3 when I learned to read, and I actually don't disbelieve that. I breathed books as a little kid, and I loved sparkling books, I think is the best way to lump them all together. Books that had joy about them. I loved Where the Wild Things Are as a little kid. That was one of my favorite picture books. I was just mesmerized and haunted by that book. And as an older kid, I loved Charlotte's Web. I think it's a perfect novel. I loved The Enchanted Castle by E. Nesbitt. I loved Edward Eger's Magic or Not and Half Magic. I loved Gone Away Lake by Elizabeth Enright. I loved The Witch Family by Eleanor Estes. I call those all of my E authors. I loved Understood Betsy by Dorothy Canfield Fisher, and it was so wonderful to eventually move to Vermont and discover that one of my favorite childhood books had been written by a Vermonter who, in fact, the state award for 4th through 8th grade children's literature is named for. Mm-hmm. It was just a very nice circularity there.
Yeah.
I loved Madeleine L'Engle's A Wrinkle in Time. There were just all of those, oh gosh, Island of the Blue Dolphins, you know, My Side of the Mountain.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, the list goes on and on and on. And those books are still loved by children. Oh, Julie Andrews, the actress.
Oh, right.
The last of the really great Wang Doodles, I must have read 21 times.
Now, when did she write that? Because she writes books with her daughter now.
She does, and those are younger books. This was a fantasy novel.
Oh, okay, I'm not
that
aware
is,
of it.
Wonder. She also wrote a great book about orphans called Mandy for middle grade readers, which is also wonderful. But this fantasy is wonderful. It's delightful. It's sparkling. I read it a billion times. And one of the highlights of my life as a bookseller was getting to meet her.
Oh, wow.
At Book Expo and having her sign my childhood copy of The Last of the Really Great Wang Doodles. Well, it was funny because she was kind of leafing through it with this bemused expression because there are little tears out of the corners of the pages, and I had to explain to her that when I really loved a book, I would tear off a little corner and eat it. You know, I actually digested pieces of my books. I'm just like, this is the little corner. Yeah.
How did she react?
I think she just smiled. She's probably thinking I was a crazy person. But
she's met.
Yeah, she's probably met many crazy people. Well, she and her daughter did a reading together at this book thing. Her daughter's a wonderful actress in her own right, Emma Walton Hamilton, and they did a performance of The King's Breakfast that was, oh, it's fantastic.
Oh, wow.
But anyway, I loved that moment. And Norton Juster, who wrote The Phantom Tollbooth, and who wrote The Dot and the Line, which is one of my favorite picture books of all time, read The Dot and the Line when he came to The Flying Pig.
Oh.
And that was, again, a fulfillment of kind of a lifelong love for this book. To be able to be in the presence of the author and hear him read it was just incredible.
That's fantastic. Okay, I want to talk a little bit about you. You blog for Publishers Weekly. Mm-hmm. And so first of all, I wanted to ask you about taking the time to blog and if that's something that you do. I didn't actually notice when I was looking at your blog posts how often they come out. And, is it something that you try really hard to do one every week, or is it just when you have an idea that you're excited about that you'll blog something?
No, we're contracted to do four a week for Publishers
Week.
Weekly.
But it's so you and Josie.
Josie does two, and I do two.
Okay, and then
usually speaking, and sometimes we'll have a guest post. Kenny Breckner, who's a bookseller in Maine, will sometimes write a guest post. And when my dad was ill, he stepped in often. Oh, I didn't do very many posts at all in May. And for me, it's two a week, and it doesn't sound like a lot, but it is. It does take a lot of time, and it does take some of the creative writing time from my week. But it's also this incredible opportunity to talk about issues of children in children's bookselling that I think are really important. It's a great platform, so it's irresistible, even though it does take a lot of time.
Yeah, but I think some people gravitate toward, I'll say it's social media, but I mean, this is more like journalism almost, because it's definitely, within your work as a bookseller and for a wonderful site, Publishers Weekly.
I would not have a blog.
Just as an author, you didn't have a blog.
I am not a social media whiz. I'm amazed people read the blog. I'm delighted people read the blog. But that blogging world is not my natural swim
pool.
So I'm always grateful and surprised when I discover that people are reading it.
Yeah. Well, one of the blog posts that you wrote, or one of your articles, I'll say, is, "Are we rushing kids out of picture books?" And you were talking about picture books a minute ago. Here's a quote from this blog post. "Adult customers and patrons who seem to be pushing children out of picture books into chapter books at younger and younger ages." And I thought that was a really interesting subject. I'm as a mother, I was always aware of the parents who were pushing their kids just to be better than, faster than. Stronger than, smarter than, whatever. And I never thought of this as an issue, but that totally rang true. So do you see a lot of that?
We do see a lot of that. We really do. The teachers don't rush the kids out of picture books. They have their own standards and testing they have to teach to, so they do need the kids to be reading other kinds of books for that purpose. But they really get the value of picture books for kids developmentally where they are. I mean, picture books were really intended for kids up to about 8.
Yeah.
And some of them are great for all ages, as you
absolutely
probably know.
Tap, tap, boom, boom.
Oh, well, thank you. And timeless, so I don't, but I think parents are worried about achievement, and they're worried about their kids not pushing themselves. But the funny thing about it is the language in picture books is often much more challenging than in those young chapter books for ages 8 to 12, which have language intended to be read independently by children. Picture books are intended for adults to read out loud to children, by and large, and so their vocabularies are very rich and very sophisticated often, and younger kids can't read them on their own. And for an 8-year-old to read Margaret Mahe's Bubble Trouble, that would be a challenge even for an 8-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
But because you can understand when you listen through context, you pick up those words. But stumbling through them to decode is harder. And I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about what picture books are.
Right.
People think that it's Go Dog Go, which is meant to be an early reader.
Right.
Or they think that it's a baby book.
See Spot Run.
See Spot Run.
Right. And Dick and Jane.
Right. But picture books are so broad a category that they cover all manner of genres and age ranges.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah.
Another one, you guys put up a blog post about awards morning, bookstore style, and it had to do with ordering books as the awards are announced so that you have them available for people. And I never thought about that, that you're kind of under the gun to get this stuff quickly sometimes. So
we are, and they're often surprise award winners. And so we are camped out with our Twitter feed running and the live stream of the ALA Awards ceremony, and we are on our warehouse database plugging in and allocating stock as fast as we can, because every other bookstore is doing that too, as are the other online behemoths, you know, nabbing up stock. They don't have to sit at their computers and do that. They, I'm sure, have other avenues for making sure they get, you know, X number of copies of the award winners with publishers. But it is kind of a fun and exciting thing to do in the morning, and nerve-wracking.
Yeah.
Because I do love the Dark Horse winners, but often the publishers have only done a small run of those books, and so they are out of stock for a month,
right,
you know, waiting to catch up to the demand.
Now, are you aware of how this all comes together? Like, let's talk about the Dark Horse winners. I mean, how does a book get nominated to be considered, or are they all sort of considered?
It depends on what award you're talking about.
Right.
I think, you know, for the Caldecott, all books considered to be picture books are eligible.
And the editors
there's a committee.
Have to submit them, or?
You know, that's a very good question, actually.
Okay.
I don't know that.
Okay.
I haven't been on the committee. I would love to be on the committee.
Oh, yeah.
But there's a committee, too, and they're reading all year. I think that, you know what, I do think the publishers send copies for consideration, and the committee members read and narrow the field for them. And it's all very hush-hush. The committee members practically sign gag orders about the proceedings and the discussions.
Wow.
I don't think you can ever really know what happened during the Newbery and Caldecott Award discussions.
Okay. Have your books been submitted for these awards? Do you know about that stuff?
I don't know about that stuff.
Okay.
I suspect that Candlewick sends in most of their picture books for that, unless it's a concept book or something that clearly isn't likely to be considered.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they would waste their time on it, but any general literary picture book, I think they would send in.
Okay, and as an author, do you ever get involved in submitting your own work for consideration to anything?
No.
Okay, just wasn't sure.
I don't know. There may be awards that one could do that for, but I'm not aware of them.
Okay. All right, great. Okay. This was another one that I thought was really interesting. On your website, you mentioned that it's hard to find lists of mysteries, adventure stories, fantasies, and picture books that happen to feature a non-white main character. And so you made a list of these books. And you came up with nearly 1,000 books that you ended up including on your list. So I'm wondering how you went about this and why you decided to do this. And, you know, sort of how did you do the research, or you know, did you solicit input from people, or how did that work?
I think having lived in cities most of my life, I was very aware when I moved to Vermont at the homogeneity of my new environment. And I felt then, as I do now, I just feel it's really important for kids to see themselves and see other people in the books they're reading. And I think it is pretty ridiculous that in the year 2014, still 90%+ of all children's books feature white people. It is ridiculous.
Yeah.
And it's actually a disservice that we're providing for white kids as well as kids of color, to say to kids of color that your story is not important, you are not worth being on the cover of a book, you are not Harry Potter, you are not the main character of a narrative, is a pretty disgusting place to be as a culture. And I don't know why I feel so passionately about this, but I do. I guess maybe as a former teacher,
mm-hmm,
as a librarian recommending books to kids, I was very disappointed not to find more books to hand to all of my students that were diverse. It was just ridiculous to me. So when I started blogging for Publishers Weekly, the thing I was most excited about was having a platform to talk about that. And I wrote an article called "Where's Ramona Quimby, Black and Pretty?" And it was all about where is the diversity? This was years ago, at least 5 years ago. And then I wrote another piece about about the lack of diversity within the publishing field itself, which is, I think, 98% white, called The Elephant in the Room. And I invited illustrators from all kinds of diverse backgrounds to create art for that article. So it's a really cool blog post because it has all of these kind of editorial cartoons illustrating this issue that were, I think, brilliantly done. And over the years, the conversation, just the culture of our nation has shifted some, and the conversation has grown and grown and grown, and more people are talking about it. And Walter Dean Myers had a great article in the New York Times recently. There's a campaign, We Need Diverse Books, that's been started. There are so many efforts now gathering steam that I feel like we're at the Malcolm Gladwell tipping point for this issue, finally.
Yeah.
Plus, it's good business for publishers to meet their market, which is not going to be an all-white market. I just think it's craziness. But anyway, so so I didn't want to just complain about it. I wanted to come up with some kind of resource for people looking for mainstream books that that aren't about race. I think part of the problem is when consumers see non-white faces on covers, they immediately associate those books with issues books and a heavier topic. So if they're in the mood for a fantasy or an adventure, that's not what they're looking for. So I think we need to get beyond, we need to normalize all kinds of faces on covers so people aren't making those assumptions. Mm-hmm. So I started just gather the books that I knew were out there that just were friendship stories, mysteries, fantasy adventure, as I've said, science fiction, and put them in this database on librarything.com. And now there are more than 1,000 books, and I do invite my sales reps to tell me about upcoming titles that would qualify for this database. I go through the online catalogs and I pull out potentials, and then I need to either read or look at them to make sure I'm accurate. Because a book might have a diverse cast of characters on the front cover, but you get inside and it's not really anyway, that's right. More of a nonfiction problem. But lots of parents use this. Some lots of teachers use it. Some parents, and I hope other booksellers and librarians are using it as a tool.
That's great.
Yeah, I know. It feels good to have it out there.
Yeah, and it must make you feel kind of happy that you started something or contributed to the conversation.
That's what I feel it is. Yeah. I do. I think I'm glad the conversation has finally taken hold in some of the hallways it needs to take hold in.
Yeah.
Because I'm one little tiny voice with, you know, very little influence, and it needs to be people who can really make change in the institutional change. That's where that conversation has to happen. So.
Okay, great. You have linked to your website a great article by Elizabeth O. Dulumba. Right? And actually, it's a how-to article. I'm not going to get into the whole thing, but she tells this great story about Dr. Seuss being at a cocktail party, and a brain surgeon says to him, I want to write a children's book someday. And then Dr. Seuss sort of says, yes, and when I have time, I'm going to do brain surgery. It's a great story. Uh-huh. Which made me think, okay, so let's talk a little bit about how does it affect you when people make it sound like some rainy Saturday when they've got nothing else to do, they're going to write a children's book. Right. Like, how do you feel about
as my friend Liza said, between breakfast and lunch, I'll knock off. Well, I think because everybody does write, everyone writes emails, everyone likes to tell stories casually, I think it's easy to feel as though, and because children are young, and people who aren't in children's books tend to think they're an easier audience than adults.
Well, I have a better vocabulary than most 6-year-olds, therefore.
Right. I'm smarter, I'm older, I'm more experienced. Surely I can toss off something they'll find interesting. And that is, you know, it's a rookie mistake. Because, you know, children, I love children as an audience because they will immediately let you know if they're bored, if the book doesn't catch them, if it's preachy, it's not going to reach them. You know, there's so many things about writing for children. You need to, in a picture book, you need to either tell a complete story in a very small space, or present a concept and illustrate it in a new and appealing way for kids. There's a lot to writing a children's book. I think that the general person doesn't know, which is true in every field. From the outside, anybody else's job looks a little easier. It really is a hard skill for people. I mean, I'm admiring of novelists' patience to slog through all the way to the end, because I get about halfway in and I count every 5 pages. You know, I think we all have different, as my sister would say, different gifts we bring to the revolution. And I think you need to have a poet's sensibility in some ways to write a good picture book, because you have to distill something to its essence.
Okay.
And I think you have to love language. I don't mean you have to necessarily be playful and crazy with language, but you have to love the efficiency of language and what it can communicate in very simply and very evocatively to children.
Okay. Well, I want to know what you're working on now, if you have a single project or a couple projects that you're working on, and if you feel like talking about them, or if you're one of those superstitious authors who doesn't want to talk about what they're working on.
Well, happily, I have a finished first draft, good draft of a book, so I can talk about it now. But it's, I usually have many things going on at once, and that is true now, but my main project at the moment is about a villainous cat. And he's
poor cats.
He's only partially redeemed by the end of it. I think cats often come off pretty well in books, but I love him. I love my villain.
Do you have a title for this book, a working title for your draft, or are you not yet?
That I will hold on to. That's before fine. I talk about it with my editor.
Okay, so you have a cat who's a villain, but kind of evolves, perhaps.
Exactly. At least just a little bit. Yeah.
Okay.
That has been really fun. That has some of my favorite language in it. It's another rhyming picture book, and it's just packed with wordplay and language. It's fun. It's fun. It's a fun project to work on.
Great. Okay. Wonderful.
I also have a middle grade novel, but again, I love my first two chapters. I think I have to ditch my third chapter and go a different direction.
Now wait, do you have middle grade novels that you've written before?
Nothing published. I've only published picture books.
Okay.
It's because I have never finished a novel.
Because you get two chapters in and decide you have to ditch.
Well, I've gotten 80 pages in.
Ooh.
To a young adult novel.
Very good.
And then sometimes I just get stuck, or it goes off the rails in a tonal way, if that makes sense, and I haven't figured out how to get it back. I think part of the problem is, because I'm really a full-time bookseller, my time for writing is scattershot. And so I think I would be able to solve some of these problems if I actually sat down every day and wrote. But because I'm not showing up to write as often as I should, it is much harder for me to sustain a novel I can work on the entire shape of a picture book in a writing session of, 3 or 4 hours. I can't do that with a novel.
Mm-hmm. And then how many weeks, months, whatever, will it take you to get to a first draft with a picture book? I'm just curious.
It depends on the picture book.
Yeah.
Some of them fly out, and then there's a lot of endless tinkering. If you spoke with my editor at Candlewick, she would say, until they are ripping it out of my hands to go to the printing press, I am still changing things. And I look at the finished books, there's still edits I would make to My Father the Dog, which has very, very few words. You would not think there was anything left to edit, but
okay.
There always is.
All right, great. Let's talk about being a bookseller a little bit more. You've been a teacher, you've been a librarian, so how do you look at your job as a bookseller, apart from just like the bottom line of trying to be able to keep the bookstore going, but your job to your patrons? Who are your patrons? And
I think I'm still a librarian.
Okay.
Really, and that's where my heart is in the business. My favorite thing to do is connect kids with books they're going to love. And I love to connect the adults with books they'll love as well. My joy in it, especially though, comes in those conversations with kids. You see kids hugging books. They light up when they realize that you have read the books that they're reading. They're so gratified and excited to talk to you about what they love and what they don't love, and we had this very funny 12-year-old girl come in with two of her best friends, and they were starting a summer reading club together. And they were looking for a book they wanted to read. And so I was asking them, what do you like? What don't you like? And she said, I said, do you like historical fiction? And she said, well, I don't know. She said, I don't like those books that are like, I saw the rain on the farm and it reminded me of Papa. And I knew exactly what kind of book she was talking about, and I did not recommend any of those. And it was so funny and trenchant a criticism of a certain kind of book. It was just funny, and I just love these conversations with kids. Yeah. You know, I had a 3-year-old with sparkly, light-up, shiny shoes yesterday who wanted to be a firefighter, this little girl. And I loved that, and so we were able to find Amazing Grace, this book about a little girl who imagines herself being all different kinds of things. And I don't know, I love the challenge of that. I love it when a kid who thinks he or she is a reluctant reader comes in and they're kind of dragged in by a parent who's like, he's my reluctant reader. And I'm thinking, what are you doing?
Right,
yes.
Right.
Well, now he is. And I'll just say, well, let me see if we can find something. Like, what do you like? So I find out what the kid likes, you know, what are your interests? Because often reluctant readers aren't fiction readers. They like nonfiction. They like to read about their interests. So you can go in that direction. Or you can just frame it as, what kind of stories, what kind of shows do you watch? Do you like, you know, adventure, outdoor, wilderness survival? You know, what interests the kid? What excites the kid? And then you can say, well, you know, here's this story about a kid. He gets stranded in this canoe going down the, you know, this river. And then they might
without
get hooked.
His mother
hovering over him. Right, exactly. It's about My Side of the Mountain, about a kid who runs away to the Catskills. In his own hollowed out tree. You might like that.
Oh, great. All right.
That's funny.
Can you talk a little bit from a bookstore owner's perspective or a bookseller's perspective, how authors should approach an independent bookstore when they are trying to get their books carried? Either self-published authors or authors whose presses are small and so they're doing some of the legwork themselves. Or even, I think, some of the larger presses, a lot of the authors have to do the legwork themselves these days. So how
No,
should
that's
an author-
a hard thing. And yeah. I always feel for authors because you don't know when you walk into a bookstore what kind of reception you're going to get. And that can depend on the kind of day the bookseller has had. You know, we probably get 2 people a day, practically, coming in to offer us a book. That either they've published or is from a very, very small house. And while we love to carry, especially local authors, you know, there are things we have to look for. So if the price point is too high, if someone's charging $18.95 for a thin paperback, that's going to be a really hard sell. If it doesn't look very professionally done, that's going to be a hard sell. We've got a sophisticated customer base. If the author doesn't ever send friends or family to the bookstore to get the book, I mean, if you're an unknown author, that's where most of your initial sales come from, are your own friends and family who know you and are invested, and then word of mouth will begin to spread. I think the biggest mistake we authors all make starting out is we sort of expect our books to find this crowd of admiring fans. But if we look at our own behavior as readers, it's not borne out. For
right.
example, I'll say to an author who wants to do an event at the bookstore, and I'm a little concerned about potential attendance because it's an unknown author, I'll say, how often do you go to a signing or a reading of an author that isn't famous? Or that you don't personally know? And usually never. And if you, who are invested in this field, don't do that, how is it that you think those other people are gonna magically appear? So
right. That,
I think, getting over some of the misconceptions about, or just kind of making those links, is helpful to authors. You know, familiarizing themselves with what is standard. For 40% is a standard bookstore discount. So the bookstore pays 60% of a book. And we pay for that within 30 days. So that inventory that's sitting in our stores is all paid for. 60% of that. So that's why it's such a hard business, because you've got a ton of inventory sitting on your shelves that you've already paid for. And the margin is small. You know, at our store, we give everybody 10% off everything that isn't already discounted 20% if it's like a hardcover bestseller. So we're already losing 10 to 20% of our margin off that. So we're left with 20 to 30% of a $10 book. That's $2 or $3. Now, out of which we need to pay payroll and overhead and all of that. All that by way of saying, every book kind of needs to earn its shelf space at the store. Independents are great because we are more accepting in some ways of, we want to support local authors. We're not always as ruthless about cutting what isn't selling. But we do need, our shelf space is precious, and so we need for it to count.
Right.
So what authors need to do is they need to be prepared to have links to independent bookstores on their own websites. If an author wants to sell books with us and they only link to Amazon, why on earth would we want to support an author who isn't supporting independents?
Right.
You know, and I think understanding that if they meet any kind of hesitation, it is really hard not to take that personally, but what it's coming out of is a bookseller who has been already approached not only by lots of authors, but also by donations. Everyone wants you to give
money to everything.
So you may have had...
interesting, because everybody understands that it's hard to keep an independent bookstore alive today. Everybody, like, that is one of our big causes now. Let's keep independent bookstores going.
Right, although so. I think people think that and say that, but I think their shopping habits are still... discount, Amazon discount driven. So I think that the reality is a little bit different. So, you know, I mean, I think independent bookstores are asking people to try to shift some of their, you're not expecting people to completely change their shopping habits, but you need your bread and butter sales to come through the local indie, not your occasional gift book. That's what will keep an independent bookstore alive, mm-hmm. is to steady regular sales, not the occasional book.
Right.
Anyway, so if authors can show that they are also supportive of a bookstore is going to be so much more interested in supporting them and their books.
Okay.
And it's true for the bookseller. You have to look at things from the author's point of view. They're nervous. This is a piece of their soul that they're handing you to judge and decide if you want. That is a really nerve-wracking thing to do, and I really do appreciate that.
Yeah.
That's a hard thing to do. And we really always try to make a decision based on, can we do justice to this book? Will it sell here? Is this the right crowd for it? And does it look professional? Can it help sell itself?
Yeah. Okay. Apart from self-published authors or local authors, what do you do with books that don't sell that you have in stock? Like, do you end up just putting them on big sale, or do you have another way to go?
Well, bookstores can return books. The return policies are a little restricted now. There's a certain time frame within which you can and can't return books. They have to, of course, be in as new condition. They take often a restocking fee. You don't get full credit necessarily. So you're losing money if you have to return books. You also have to pay to ship them back. Mm-hmm. So you try to order wisely so you don't have to do that.
Right.
And often we will try to sell books at a discount, which might actually get us a better deal than if we sent them back, paid for shipping, and took a little bit of a hit on a restocking fee.
Right. Okay. So I always end up asking for a little bit of advice for listeners who might be writers, and in your case, writers of children's books. We won't say necessarily just picture books, but writers of all different children's books. What, if you have a specific piece of advice or general advice for this group of people?
I have to say, I know people are very discouraging about the market, but I really do believe that good writing will find its place, will find a home. And the best thing I can say is read a lot in the field, read a lot out of the field too. Just read a lot and write. That's when inspiration happens. You have to show up for it to happen. So be more disciplined than I am would be a big piece of advice. And also, I really do think that a wonderful story or a beautiful piece of writing exists for a reason, and it will find its audience, and you do have to have faith. I know so many very, very famous writers who got so many rejections starting out, and it is that combination of perseverance, talent, and luck. Mm-hmm. It really is that triumvirate right there that will carry the day.
Yeah.
You can't control the luck, but you can control the perseverance. And the talent piece, you're born with a certain amount of it, and you acquire a certain amount of it through work. You know, Malcolm Gladwell in Outliers, I think, talks about the 10,000 hours it takes to master a craft, to achieve mastery. And I do think that's true with writing. The more you do it, the looser the engine becomes, the more creative you can be, and the more facile you are in a good way.
Great. Thank you very much. This was
really
fun.
Thank you. It was so nice to talk with you.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with Elizabeth Blumley. Her name is spelled B-L-U-E-M-L-E, and you can learn more about her work at elizabethblumley.com. So my son and I once experienced a hurricane in Florida. Those of you who know storms might remember Hurricane Charley in 2004. So he and I stayed in a motel in Winter Park, Florida, two stories looking out over a parking lot, not a very exciting hotel. And the storm was really loud and really fierce. We lost electricity and the room went dark. And outside the winds were just so loud. It sounded like the world was going to end. And then the eye of the storm came over the motel and our area of Winter Park, and there was just this eerie silence. And we walked outside, and all the hotel guests were stepping out of their rooms and standing just in a row together, leaning over the metal railings, looking down at the parking lot and talking. And, you know, talking about the storm, about, you know, when did you lose power, and, you know, or how did you get here, or did you have trouble making a reservation? And eventually we started to feel a kind of rapport that comes from facing the unknown. I think weather events can do this. When the winds picked up again, we all went back inside into our darkened rooms, and, you know, we kind of felt like we knew the neighbors who were in the rooms nearby. So anyway, this week's Write the Book prompt is to write about a weather incident that brings people together, as they do in the subway in Elizabeth Blumley's book, Tap Tap Boom Boom. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. The Kellogg Hubbard Library is organizing submissions for the annual Montpelier Poem City event. Vermonters of all ages are invited to submit original poetry for the library's annual celebration of National Poetry Month. You can find out more information at the Kellogg Hubbard Library website. A reminder to all of you who write, I do share a writing prompt each week, so be sure to tune in, or if you miss one, check the archives of Write the Book if you'd like to find any of the writing prompts that you might have missed. I would love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors or if you have events to announce. Also, be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, which is writethebook.podbean.com. You can also find us on other sites where you might get your podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pandora, lots of other sites. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook and on all the different social media sites. You can access the podcast at my own website, which is shelaughswithoutus.com. If you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and talk about it. I'm going to end with the theme song for the show, and then at 5, stay tuned for Feminist Frenzy, the radio show with a feminist agenda. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Stay well and have a great week.